But we've arrived. This is the last week in our Nehemiah series. 11 weeks on this. I said that this morning. Some of our worship team was like, 11 weeks? Really? Are you sure? I'm like, yeah, I counted it up. So 11 weeks to walk through the 13 chapters of the book of Nehemiah. I hope that you've been as encouraged listening to this series as I have been and Dave has been in bringing these messages to you. And it's so crazy how applicable God's word is to our lives and to our church and to where we are at and what we're doing right now. So I hope that you've enjoyed this series. But I want just this morning as we start out and look at chapter 13, I just want you to think about something just for a moment. I want you to think about what if Peter, after he betrayed Jesus, remember on the night in the garden and he denied him three times after outside the high priest's courthouse, and then he ran off. Later we find out that Peter went back to fishing. What if when Peter went back to his old job, he stayed in it? So here he is. He had been poured into for 3 years by Jesus. He makes a really big mistake. Things fall apart that he had poured into. Guys that he loved all betrayed. They all scattered. And then he went back to his old job. After 3 years, he went back to fishing. What if Peter had never come back to Jesus? What if he hadn't come back to the disciples? It's amazing because when Peter went back to his old job, remember what happened when Jesus came to him? Peter says, I'm going out and I'm going fishing in John 21. And so they go out in the water and it says all night long they caught nothing. He's a commercial fisherman. He's thinking, I got this. I'm going to go right back to my old life and pick up right where I left off, and everything's going to be fine. I'll provide for my family. I don't need anybody. I can do this on my own. And then remember, Jesus shows up, and he says, hey, why don't you try the other side of the boat? Again, to a professional fisherman? How would you like to hear that from someone yelling it from the shore? Yeah, okay, thanks, pal. Appreciate it. I don't know if they're going to be any better 10 feet on this side of my boat than they are under the boat, but okay, fine, we'll do it. They put it on the other side, and of course, there's way too big a haul to bring in. Jesus once again showing Peter, first of all, revealing himself to Peter that it's him, because he did that the first time. But also, secondly, he shows that Peter can't even do his old job without Jesus' help. That apart from Jesus, we really are nothing. You walk through the list of people that have been used by God to do great things in the Bible. What if they got a setback or everything they'd pour their lives into? When all that started to fall apart, what if they never went back? What if they never re-engaged or re-entered it? Think about Moses. What if Moses had used all of his old, moments to say, oh my goodness, he's caught and he kills the Egyptian. He runs into the wilderness for 40 years. He's tending sheep, his father-in-law's flock. And then God comes and finds him and says, you got to go back to Egypt. I can't, literally. I can't. I have a speech impediment. I stutter. I can't. I don't have the ability to talk. I don't have the ability to lead people. Who should I say? Well, send me. Tell them I am sent you. Okay, so not only that, but then I have to share some complex theological thing to people when they ask me where I'm from. What if Moses had said no to that and hadn't gone back? What if David, after he was pointed out by Nathan, said, you know what, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I'm going back to shepherding my father's flock. I've made huge mistakes. I'm way over my head. I gave in with this woman. I did the thing I shouldn't do. God's not going to use me. We lost our child now. He's broken. He's lost. He's destitute. He's hurting. And he says, you know what? What if he just said, I'm going back home. I'm going back to the life of a shepherd. I can't stick this out. What's amazing about the Bible is that we don't cover up the mistakes of our heroes. We don't gloss over their weaknesses. We don't pretend that they weren't murderers. We don't pretend that they weren't liars. We don't pretend that they weren't adulterers. We don't pretend those things didn't happen. We say they happened. Why? Because God can use anyone to accomplish his purpose. But what he wants from us is surrender. What he wants from us is re-engagement. What he wants from us is not to walk away for good. He wants us to come back. Because how often is it in that time of testing? How often is it during that time where we felt we weren't good enough? When Peter stepped away for 50 days between his betrayal of Jesus on that night and when he stood up at Pentecost and preached the message heard around the world for 50 days, he's humbled, he's tested, he's taught, he's prepared to change the world for Jesus. It's amazing how you look at these lives, and because they've tasted something of God, because they would taste and see that the Lord is good, because they experienced something with God, because they walked with Jesus for 3 years, they were ruined for anything else. They couldn't go back to anything else. It's like someone sits down and has a piece of pie that's made by Mom Holdridge with a slice of sharp cheddar cheese for some reason that I still haven't quite figured out. And what do you say when you're eating that? This is the best thing I've ever had in my life. I'm ruined for Hostess and McDonald's apple pies. I cannot go back to those. Or maybe you have a latte or a drink downstairs after one of our worship nights that's artfully crafted for you by one of our Calvary baristas. And we hand it to you and you take a sip and go, I'm ruined for gas station coffee. I can't go back. I can't do that little powdered cappuccino nonsense pushing under the little spigot. We think about our lives. I think about these people. It's like once they tasted and saw that God was good, once they experienced God in a fresh and a powerful way, once they saw what they saw, they were ruined. They couldn't go back to their old lives. Try as they might, they could not go back. Because once you see and hear and taste and touch and experience what God is up to and he uses you, there's really no going back. You can't go back. In Nehemiah chapter 13, we have sort of the final, not sort of, literally, the last chapter of this book. We start the last chapter. And interestingly enough, the first three verses of this book, it's sort of a flash forward to a future event, and then it goes back and kind of backfills what set this up. But just to give a quick summary of the narrative here where we are in the book, you've got Nehemiah. He is a cupbearer for King Artaxerxes in Babylon, or in a Persian Empire, and he's over there and he's living in Susa, and even though his heritage was Jewish, he was still there after they were brought into captivity. And Nehemiah is there and he hears from his brother that Jerusalem's walls are knocked down, and it's a mockery, it's a laughing stock, it's a bad situation. The holy city of God is just able to be taken advantage of by anyone. So he fasts, he prays, he weeps, he mourns, he asks God to use him to be a part of this process. And God answers and gives him an opportunity to go back to Jerusalem, traveling the two-month journey, almost 1,000 miles each way to get to Jerusalem. He brings timbers from cedars from Lebanon and all this other stuff he brings with him to go ahead and rebuild these walls. And he walks around the city in the night and he sort of inspires the rabble that's still there. And this unlikely group of non-builders, non-architects, non-wall building people, perfumers and politicians and daughters and moms and dads, just people that don't know what they're doing construction-wise, all band together and build this wall in 52 days. While they're building it, intense opposition arises. Villains are revealed. Sanballat is a villain who comes against them. Tobiah is a villain and an enemy that comes against them constantly trying to undercut it. When they get it all done, then the people, when it's all done, they celebrate it. And then they get together and they read from the Bible for the first time, many of them in their lives, and they realize how far they were from God. And then they want to come together and make a covenant before God and say, we won't do this again. We won't wander from you. We won't stray. They make the covenant, and then they dedicate the wall, and they celebrate last week. That was our moment out in the lobbies. We celebrated and dedicated that space to God together. So here we are now. Nehemiah has spent 12 years as governor of that region around Jerusalem, including Jerusalem. But if you remember, the deal that Nehemiah made with Artaxerxes was he would only be gone for a certain amount of time, and then he would return home to fulfill his duties as a high-ranking court official, as a cupbearer to the king. And so here we are in chapter 13. This is the moment where Nehemiah attempts to leave Jerusalem and go back to his old life in Susa. So verse 1, this is the flash forward we see. Verse 1 says, on that day, they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people. And in it was found that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God. For they did not meet the people of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. Yet our God turned the curse into a blessing. As soon as the people heard the law, they separated from Israel all those of foreign descent. Now before this, look at verse 4. Now before this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, and who was related to Tobiah. Let's just pause right there. Eliashib, remember the high priest back in chapter 3? He was one of our heroes. We talked about him Sunday morning saying he was a leader who built the wall and he just said, we're going to build the sheep gate. And he built the gate and they dedicated it and they consecrated it and they prayed and he was willing to get in the mud with the people and build this gate. Well, now we find out he's related to Tobiah, one of the named enemies throughout the book of Nehemiah. So Eliashib is related to Tobiah. So here's this hero in the beginning of the book. Now, what does Eliashib do as high priest? He prepared, verse 5, he prepared for Tobiah a large chamber where they had previously put the grain offerings, the frankincense, the vessels, and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil, which were given by commandment to the Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, and the contributions for the priests. So you see what's happened here? The high priest was in charge of the chambers. He goes to Tobiah, the sworn enemy of Nehemiah and this whole project. And we find out why in a moment. But he gets all of this stuff out, all of the grain offerings, all the stuff that was supposed to be used for the Levites and for the temple operations to work. He cleans that out, and then he allows Tobiah to move in. Eliashib allows Tobiah to have an apartment in the temple courts. The enemy. Why? Well, look at verse 6. While this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem, Nehemiah says. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king. So I returned to the king. After some time, I asked leave of him and came back to Jerusalem. And I then discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. Isn't it amazing that when God's appointed leader, the godly leader that he was, as soon as he left, the enemy moved in. When Nehemiah moved out, the enemy moved right in, almost immediately. The high priest that had been so courageous and bold and real down to earth with the people and such a great example immediately sided with the enemy. He gave in to pressure. I'm sure there was pressure. Tobiah and Sanballat were relentless in their pressure. I mean, think about what must be going through his mind. He cleans out the tithes and he moves in and gives a luxurious apartment to their number one enemy. It's amazing how fast it happened. The villain moved in. When Nehemiah moved out, the enemy moved right in. How amazing is that example? How often that happens? The moment we drop our guard, the moment we step away from what God has done, the moment we think that it's okay to relax, and boy, the intensity of these 12 years under Nehemiah and his reforms and coming back to God and building the wall and building the temple, rebuild, you know, doing all the things they did, moving into the city. The moment you drop your guard, someone allows the enemy to move right in, right into the temple. And what does this do for the example to the people? The people knew what they were supposed to do, and they're watching the high priest behave this way. It has an amazing effect. It's like a giant snowball effect that's rolling down the mountain here because everything starts to fall apart. So Nehemiah's gone. He hears, invariably, he hears what's going on. He just had returned. Now imagine you're Nehemiah, and you're back. 12 years, you were a part of the greatest mission of your life. You walked in, you saw the walls rebuilt, you're leading people, you know, you're fighting off enemies, you're dedicating things, you're governing, you're ruling, you're overseeing the rebuilding of a city, people are moving in. It's exciting. Then all of a sudden, you got to go back. You got to go back to your old life. Imagine Nehemiah trying to sit there at a banquet where he's now pouring the wine, handing it to the king. and the conversations around him about politics and leadership and things have nothing to do with him. He's got to now pretend to be something he's not anymore. He's got to pretend to be a cupbearer when he's really a governor. He's got to pretend to be something he's not. Imagine his daydreams. Imagine, I could just imagine him being there and someone being like, Nehemiah, what are you doing? Get out there. What are you staring out the window for? Get back in the game. What are you doing? You're his cupbearer. Like, you got to be sniffing out rebellion. You got to engage. Why aren't you engaging? You've been gone for 12 years. I know I see the new guy in charge be like, well, my father's thought very highly of you, so I put you back in position, but you got to start doing your job here, man. Where's your head at? Get in the game. You'll hear stories of men that were war heroes overseas. So engaged, dodging bullets, rescuing their friends, winning great victories, and coming back home to old jobs and standing there like paper or plastic. And in their minds they're going, this isn't who I am. I miss that life. I want to get back to that. The servant was actually a governor. The servant was actually one of the greatest leaders in human history. This book of Nehemiah uses a blueprint for leadership for 2,000 years. We've looked at this. But he heard that things were going south in Jerusalem. He heard things were going bad, and he had a choice to make. Nowhere in here does he say, I heard things were going bad in Jerusalem, and the God of heaven said, go back, Nehemiah, go fix it, Nehemiah. He doesn't say, and the Lord put it on my heart to go back. He just says, I was there for a while, and then I asked the king to let me go back. Imagine that conversation. I know I've only been back. Now commentators say that one of the most respected ones I studied for this said he was only back in Susa for 3 to 6 months. So 2 months to get there, 3 to 6 months on the ground back in his old job, and then 2 months to get back. So we're talking a total year here. Imagine that moment where he has to stand before the king and be like, I hate to ask you this, but can I go back? I just miss it. Things are going down in flames. We don't have record of that conversation, but he had to ask the king again if he would let him go back, and the king said yes. You wonder if a king who was a very wise leader, and we know that from chapter 1 and 2, how he dealt with Nehemiah, you wonder if he's almost like, I was wondering when you were going to ask me that. Took you long enough. All of us could see it in you. We've heard great things. Go back, Nehemiah. That's where you're supposed to be. But what if he had said no? What if he heard these bad reports and he said, you know what? I'm done. I'm back in my job. I got my nice house back. I've got 2 more years of this, and then I coast into a nice Babylonian retirement. I got a place in this house on the water. I'm done with that. 12 years of my life I gave to those people, and they can't keep it going. What if he said no? Let somebody else do it. God will call someone else. But no, again, he stepped up and went back. But imagine if he had said no. The people would not have been able to be under his leadership again. Think about what a loss that would have been for the people of Jerusalem, because God had called Nehemiah and created him to do this, to be the leader, to be the one who could govern and keep people on the right path. So what does he do? As soon as he gets back, verse 7, he came to Jerusalem and he discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And I was very angry. And I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. So he walks back into town, goes into Tobiah's house, and just starts taking couches and chucking them out the window. He doesn't say, I found people to do this. He said, I did it. Oh, you like this vase, buddy? Oh, this is your grandmother's chair. Awesome. Throwing stuff out the door. Get this stuff out of here. He was angry, and so he walked into the temple, and he threw it all out. Does that remind you of anybody that's going to come later? Sometimes there's a moment where you just have to grab stuff and chuck it out. Enough. This is ridiculous. And he had to do it himself. We don't have any evidence that Tobiah was there, but if he was, I see him scampering. There's no reasoning. There's no dealing. There's no requesting. There's no, Tobiah, I know we've been through a lot. I know we don't always see eye to eye, but I got a 30-day notice I'm putting on here. I really need you to move. We got a different spot for you. No, when the enemy has come in, someone needs to grab him by his neck and his stuff and throw him out for the sake of the people, for the sake of the movement to continue. He was angry and he threw him out. Then I gave orders. I love that. After I threw everything out, then I gave some orders. And they cleansed the chambers, and I brought back the vessels of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. So after this was literally cleansed, he put the stuff back that needed to be in there. But verse 10, I found out that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled to his field. You see how fast everything's falling apart? They had just brought the Levites back. Remember last week, we're putting the band back together. We're going to find, we sought the Levites everywhere they were. They all came back. The system's working, operating. Now it says the portion wasn't given to them. We don't see if it was because people had stopped tithing, although we think that eventually happened from the text. But it also seems to say if Tobiah is sitting in the room where all the stuff is, maybe, just maybe, the wine is being drunk by Tobiah and his friends and they're not giving it to the Levites. They're not giving them the grain to live off of. They're not providing for them. So it got so bad that they had to go back home and figure out how to make a living again. Isn't it amazing when one action happens, the dominoes just start to fall? Now, because of the sin that the high priest had done, now the grain offering, you know, the Levites aren't being taken care of anymore. And because of that, the people stopped giving, stopped tithing. Now the Levites have nowhere to go. They have nothing to eat. They have nowhere to, they got to go back home and try and find a way to scrape a living again. They got to go back to the deli that they quit. They got to go back to the shop they worked at. They got to go back home and reopen shop and be like, well, it was a good couple of years, but I guess it's over. So I confronted the officials, verse 11, and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their stations. I love it. Don't you just see him grabbing people like, you, right here. That's your spot. Stay there. You, come here. Right here. That's your spot. Stay here. Why have we forsaken the house of God? Why are we neglecting the house of God? This is exact verbiage out of our covenant that we made. You're going back on the covenant already. We said we wouldn't do this, and you're doing this. Verse 12, then all of Judah brought the tithe of the grain, wine, and oil into the storehouses. So everyone said, okay, it's time. Let's bring our tithes in. So people had stopped giving. They'd stopped tithing. They bring their stuff back in. Verse 13, and I appointed as treasurers over the storehouses Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, Pedaiah of the Levites, and as their assistant, Hanan, the son of Zachar, son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable, and their duty was to distribute to their brothers. So he's putting better leadership in place over this. He thought he knew Eliashib, and he did not. He thought he knew somebody. He thought he knew Shemaiah back in the earlier chapters, and he betrayed him. So now he's like, give me the most trustworthy men that we know and put them in these important positions. So he reassigned jobs. And look at verse 14, I love this. Because when you're doing this kind of work as a leader, when he's doing this kind of work, it's not popular. No one wants to have their lamp chucked out into the courtyard. No one likes to be embarrassed. No one likes to be mocked. And this was showing everybody up. So what does he say in verse 14? Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for his service. God, in the midst of this, just remember what I'm doing. Remember, don't blot out all the good that I did just because it's all going downhill. Please, God, remember me and what I've done for you. They've gone back. They've gone back on their covenant. Not only did they allow the enemy to come in, but then they also stopped giving. They stopped tithing. They started to neglect the house of God. And Nehemiah is saying, we aren't going back. We are not going back to the way things were before. We are pushing forward. we know that God is good and we know that there's more for us. We're not going back. Look at verse 15. The next thing that they broke was the Sabbath. Verse 15, in those days I saw in Judah people treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in heaps of grain and loading them on donkeys and wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them on the day when they sold food, verse 16, Tyrians also, who lived in the city, brought in fish and all kinds of goods and sold them on the Sabbath to the people of Judah in Jerusalem itself. Then I confronted the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this evil thing you're doing, profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers act in this way? And did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Now you're bringing more wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. As soon as it began to grow dark, verse 19, at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors be shut and gave orders that they should not be opened until after the Sabbath. And I stationed some of my servants at the gates that no load might be brought in on the Sabbath day. This is great. Look at verse 20. It's especially appropriate on the week of Black Friday. Verse 20, then the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. They're spending night outside the city, waiting to get in, waiting to sell, people waiting to buy. But I warned them, verse 21, and said to them, why do you lodge outside the wall? It's only a $40 Blu-ray player. It's not that much to give up this much time. Oh, that's not in there, sorry. Why do you lodge outside the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. Now, just to clarify, this is not that like commissioning laying of hands. It's very nice, and we gather around and we pray over someone. It's a very beautiful biblical symbolic thing, New Testament. This is a different kind of laying hands. This is a ferocious beating, Nehemiah is referencing. If you do this again, I will lay hands on you. You'll answer to me. I will violently dispel you from this. And he's already got the reputation. He was chucking chairs out. He was chucking out TVs and radio, all the stuff he threw out the window with Tobiah. He's saying, I will defend. Isn't it amazing how much of a shepherd he feels like here? At moments, he pulls out the staff to protect the sheep. It's an amazing picture. Then I commanded. From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. So that was solved. The threat of violence took care of that. Verse 22, then I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come and guard the gates to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember this also in my favor, O my God, and spare me according to the greatness of your steadfast love. Again, he's doing something highly unpopular. People wanted to work. They wanted to make more money. They wanted to be able to walk outside their door in downtown Jerusalem and buy purses and buy food. They were hungry. They didn't want to have to plan for Sabbath. Actually practicing the Sabbath in this time was quite a thing. Your whole week was oriented around Sabbath observance. So if you could walk outside and get your coffee and donut without having to plan for it ahead of time, boy, that was nice. And they kind of went that easy, convenient route rather than obeying God. Verse 23. So the second way they violated the covenant was by not practicing the Sabbath. It's amazing. In the covenant language in chapter 9, it even says, we will not allow people to come into our walls and sell. It's so incredibly specific. It wasn't even like a loophole offered. And this is exactly what they allowed to happen. Just a few months, maybe even days after he left, they allowed it to happen. Verse 23, and those days also I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and half of their children spoke language of Ashdod. And they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. So let me pause there 1 second. This, at first glance, you're like, so teach them to speak Hebrew. What's the problem? He is saying here, if our children are forgetting their heritage, if our children are no longer, they're not going to walk with God. They saw intermarriage here, not just as like, oh, you know, we're racist and we're against these people, but it was more than that, just that. It was the idea that when you married into another people group, that was a fast track to idolatry because you were marrying into their religious system. And the Israelites were set apart to God. And so if you married someone from Ashdod or you married someone from Moab, the chances are they had their whole pantheon of gods that they worshipped. And now suddenly, look at Ahab and Jezebel. Jezebel brought with her Baal worship. She brought with her Asherah worship. She brought with her all of the false gods. And what happened? Threw the nation into confusion. So it wasn't just the sake of this relationship. It wasn't the sake of trying to deny what the true heart wanted. It's not like that. It's saying, my goodness, God saw it from a bigger perspective, that was a symbol of their hearts wandering to other gods. And he's saying, boy, if the children aren't speaking the language anymore, we are going to lose our heritage, our legacy. The next generation is no longer going to follow God. Now, verse 25 is one of the more interesting verses you'll find in the Bible. And some of us as leaders may a time or two have maybe fantasized about being able to confront someone in this way when there's something they continually do. But this is not going to happen anytime soon. At least it's not being planned. Verse 25, and I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. I mean, Nehemiah is on a rampage. I mean, he confronts them. That apparently didn't go well. So then he curses them. That didn't have the desired effect. Then he went ahead and beat them up. That still didn't quite do it. And then he decided to yank out their hair. I mean, outside of the sons of Sceva in Acts 19, I can't think of a better just straight-up beating passage as this. The only thing it's missing is, and they went off naked and bleeding. That's really what's missing here. But he was so fighting for this and so committed to this and so passionate about this, he even went to extremes to enforce it. And I made them take the oath in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. He made them. This is like torture. He's beating them, pulling their hair out, saying, will you take the oath now? No, I won't. Well, then the beating. No, I won't. Then the hair. Now, okay, I will. I mean, this is intense language here. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women among the many nations? There was no king like him, and he was beloved by God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women? So the next area they violated the covenant was they went back on their promise to not marry foreign women. And look at verse 28. And one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, now listen very closely to this, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was the son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Okay, can I just, both of the number one enemies in the book of Nehemiah, one is living in the temple and the other one married the high priest's daughter. Can you imagine just the confounding rage? What are you doing? Sanballat, Tobiah, the whole time we're here, they've been against us, and now you're letting your son marry his daughter, and you are letting, you know, you're letting Tobiah set up shop here. Eliashib had absolutely sold out, 100%. So what does Nehemiah do? Therefore, I chased him from me. Now, we don't know exactly how old Nehemiah is at this point, but he had advanced to a high position in Persia. He had spent 12 years already as governor. Commentators will say he was probably 50s, 60s at this point, possibly. So let's just pick 60. Chasing the high priest's son-in-law, chasing him. I mean, this is a spectacle. This is sort of a precursor to all of us dads with daughters that are like, get out. In fact, when I was, I'll just tell you this story and just, you know, whatever. We'll let the chips fall where they may. But I remember when I was younger, my sister was dating someone that my dad just did not like or trust. And I remember one day he kind of lipped off to my dad. And I was in the garage doing some, like, Saturday afternoon project. It's always me cleaning out garages. It's like a theme of my life. Anyway, I'm in there, but there were those windows in the garage, and I looked out, and I watched my dad, who wasn't in fantastic physical condition, was not an athlete by any stretch, kind of just some weird adrenaline-fueled sprint off the steps and start to chase this kid. And this was like an all-state basketball player. I mean, I'm pretty sure he just jumped from the house to his car and like laid rubber tracks and squealed down the street, never to be seen again. That's what I picture here. My dad, whatever, however old he was, chasing this little weaselly punk into his car and screaming down the road. Whew, I remember being like, okay, note to self. See what my parents think of these girls that I'm taking out beforehand. I want to avoid that, although I don't know if they would chase off a girl. Anyway, He chased them off. Verse 29, remember them, O my God, because they have desecrated the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I cleanse them from everything foreign, and I established the duties of the priests and Levites, each in his work, and I provided for the wood offering at appointed times and the first fruits. So even he's like, I even provided the wood. When other people didn't do it, I stepped in and filled in. And then the last line of this book, remember me, God, for good. Remember me, God, for good. All that Nehemiah cared about was not that he was remembered by anyone else. He just wanted God to see what he had done, because it was being done not for Nehemiah's name, but for God's name. It's a powerful conclusion to an incredible book. Nehemiah chose to come back. He chose to re-engage and try to stem the tide, try to reverse the course, try to put the dominoes back up, try to stop what was going on. 12 years of his life had been spent trying to get this country going in the right direction, and within a matter of months or a few short years possibly, it had all started going downhill fast. And so he re-engaged. He chose to re-engage, say, God, I am coming back. Because I don't belong. I don't belong in Susa anymore. I belong in Jerusalem. I belong as a part of your movement. And so he came back. It's amazing to think that God had created Nehemiah so particularly and so amazingly that his leadership, his passion, his courage, his intellect, and his ability to communicate and use diplomacy, God had created him for a specific purpose and called him to a specific purpose. And he chose to come back and step into that rather than settle into a cozy life and pretend he didn't even know what was going on in Jerusalem. What's amazing about that is to think that there was something that Nehemiah needed to do. There was something God had created Nehemiah to do, and if he stopped doing it, things started to fall apart. I love to think about the church this way. I love to think about each of you that way, because God has created each of us and called each of us to a specific thing that only we can do. And if we don't do it, no one else will. And the enemy's going to show up immediately the moment we desert it. Maybe you've been created and called to love your wife. No one else is going to do that but you. You've been created by God and called by him to raise your children up to love Jesus as best as you can, to raise them and love them. No one else is going to do that for you. And if you step away from that for a moment, someone else is going to move right in. There's a coworker that I will never meet, but you know them. Guess what? You've been created by God and called to them. Once you meet them and they don't know Jesus, guess whose responsibility it is to at least share with them about who he is? It's not mine. I don't know him. It's yours. You've been created and called by God to do something. And here's what's amazing. The moment we stop doing that, the moment we put our hands behind our head and say, you know what? I worked hard. Summer of 98, I killed myself and this pastor betrayed me. Or I did this and this church fell apart. Or I did this and my neighbor betrayed me. Or I did this and she left me. I did this and he hurt me. And we sit back and we do that and we use those excuses. Well, then someone else is going to zoom into those areas that we could have been a part of. And the whole delicate tower can crumble. We need you to do what only you can do here. We need you to step into what God has created and called you to do. How many Nehemiahs are in this room? How many Moseses are in this room? What if Abraham had been like, you know what, I'm done with this. God, I'm sorry I said she was my sister. I don't know. I can't do this anymore. You aren't giving us a son. I'm 90. I'm tired. I'm old. Just can Lot be kind of my sort of son? No. They re-engaged and did what God created and called them to do. And we now walk on their coattails. But they weren't perfect people. They made mistakes and they fell. But they re-engaged. So I don't know where you are this morning in all of this, but I can tell you right now that once you give your life to Jesus, because all of them surrendered, that's the key. Peter surrendered to God's plan for his life. Abraham surrendered a very wealthy living. They all said, okay, I'll follow you. They weren't glamorous people. My goodness, Rahab, what did she do for a living? Yeah, the world's oldest profession. Yet she's listed among the heroes of our faith. That's the kind of movement I want to be a part of. We're not afraid to say that God can transform anyone and use anyone. And therefore, we're without total excuse. If God can use Rahab, he can use you. If God can use Moses, he can use you. If God can use Gideon, he can use you. The key is surrender. Because once you surrender and give your life to him and start moving forward, you're ruined for anything else. You can't go back. I've tried. I've tried to go back a couple times. I've stepped out of ministry and said, okay, I had this successful fishing business. If I was Peter, I can go back and just start fishing again. You know, I did a lot of sales in college, did pretty well. I can go back to sales. I can't go back. I can't go back. I find myself staring out the window, thinking about what God is up to right now, what churches are doing, what people that I love are doing, and I just can't go back. I've tried. I even tried when I moved here. This was a serious attempt to go back. But once you've tasted and seen that a life lived for God in surrender is better than anything else, there is no going back. So for some of you that are there, you are Nehemiah back in Susa, and you're like, I tried, I gave my heart to it, and it fell apart. No matter how old you are or how young you are, God is saying today, I've called you and created you to do this. You need to re-engage. Re-engage with your spouse. Re-engage with your children. Re-engage in your leadership abilities. Re-engage with the coworker. Re-engage with your neighbor. Re-engage with your original call to missions. Re-engage with who God has created you to be, because if you don't do it, guess who moves in? Immediately. Guess who moves into that relationship with your spouse? If you are detached and gone, guess who moves in? And then you wonder why there's so much distance and chaos in that relationship. Re-engage. You're called and created to do something only you can do. And God's grace and forgiveness is over all of it. So you've made a mistake. You've made 1,000 mistakes. I promise you I've made more. God chooses to use the broken and the weak and those who are not, because it gives him the most glory. I look in this room, I'm like, we've got way more than 12 disciples in here. And yet 12 flipped the world upside down. Why? Because the Spirit of God was given to them and they were given a calling. What has changed? What is different about us and them? Same Spirit, same calling, same God, same world. 2,000 years later, sure. We can turn this area upside down with the cause of Jesus Christ. What would it look like to live each day engaged in what God had created you to do? What would that look like? What would that feel like? I promise you, once you taste of it, you cannot go back. We're ruined. We're ruined by Jesus. Nehemiah's life was ruined. His career as a cupbearer was forever blank-walled, ruined. He couldn't go back. He had to stay with what God had created and called him to do. I pray as a church that we can live that way. Ruin to anything but following Jesus. We're out of time. Why don't you stand with me as we pray? God, we just love you so much. I thank you for this morning. I thank you for this series. I pray, God, that we would not go back to the way things were in our lives. We would not go back to the way things were when they were safer, when we could provide for ourselves, that we would stay in this season you have us, and we'd ask you for even more. Thank you that you invite us into more. But if we choose to disengage, the consequences are apparent. I pray, God, that through your Spirit and your invitation and your grace and love and mercy, you'll give us the courage to re-engage into what you've created and called us to do in this world. I pray we can be that kind of a church. We don't ever want to go back. It's in the powerful name of Jesus Christ that we ask it. Amen.